Can I tell T my favorite fish joke?
Yeah, go for it.
Why did the fish blush?
Because he saw the ocean's bottom.
Oh! I should have known you would have known that one.
Why'd the fish get kicked out of the school? Got caught with seaweed.
I think we need to put those in the podcast. So welcome to Innovation in the Berg, a podcast about science and innovation in St. Petersburg. If you're a self-described science or technology geek, or even if you aren't, this will be a fun and informative conversation. I'm Allison Barlow, Executive Director of the St. Pete Innovation District. Each podcast, I'm joined by a local science or technology expert who will talk about what they are working on. But to make sure we keep this in perspective and we don't become too technical, we have a community member joining us. Our hope is that you learn something new and enjoy our conversation. Let me introduce today's guests. Our expert is Dr. Maya Brabart from the USF College of Marine Science. In every milliliter of surface seawater, there is 1 million bacteria and 10 million viruses. Microbes are very diverse and play an important role in our global carbon and nutrient cycling. Maya has spent over a decade studying this and examines the role of viruses and bacteria in a wide range of environments, including seawater, animals, plants, insects, zooplankton, coral reefs, and a reclaimed water. Our community member is T. Grizzard. T. is a self-described fish geek who is an avid fisherman in his free time and also an artist who uses fish in part of his artwork. So we might need to ask T. a little bit about that. So Maya, let me get you started first. Tell us a little bit, how did you get started in the world of marine science and bacteria and viruses?
Yeah, two different starts, I think, to different parts of that story. So I grew up with a lot of science exposure. My parents are both scientists. My dad is a food chemist and my mom is a geneticist. So we always had a lot of opportunities to learn about science, which of course does not mean you go into science. My brother wanted nothing to do with science, but I latched onto science pretty quickly. And the marine science love really came from the Girl Scouts. So I was a Girl Scout from kind of day one and grew up in that system and had an opportunity to go on a lot of national and international trips with Girl Scouts that all centered around water. So we did one in Malaysia called Our Water, Our World, which was all about the connectivity of water supplies and how what impacts one person impacts the other. I did my first research vessel cruise as a high schooler out in the Great Lakes, which now I do lots for research. And I think most influential on Topsail Island, which is unfortunately being pounded by a hurricane right now, but working with a sea turtle nesting program. And those were all things that really drove my love of the marine environment. But I think like a lot of young people, I wanted to work on the big charismatic animals, you know, the dolphins and manatees and turtles. And it really wasn't until I got to my undergraduate degree at Florida Institute of Technology that I started realizing that all of these animals, as well as everything else out there, was covered in bacteria and viruses, including us. So don't start washing your hands yet, but our microbes are a really important part of everything that we do. And kind of seeing that and having my first research experience, I got to work on isolating bacteria from sponges that were collected from Antarctica. Mm. And our goal there was to identify like new chemical compounds, like antibiotics that could be used possibly for health applications. And that was kind of the hook for me when I realized that I could combine my love of the marine environment with this interest in microbiology. After that, I did a summer internship at Scripps Institute of Oceanography in California and started learning about marine viruses, which was something I'd never thought about before. And like you said in your introduction, there are 10 billion like marine viruses in a liter of seawater. So 10 million in a milliliter, in a teaspoon, basically, right? That's a ton of them. Most of them aren't anything that would cause problems for us, but they're really important parts of the marine food webs. And so from that moment on, I was hooked into both the marine and the microbiology.
And it makes me a little scared, T, when I hear her say microbes and all of this stuff.
She had me hooked.
So you said it's okay that those are out there, the bacteria and the viruses.
Absolutely. So bacteria are basically the base of our food web. So when you think about, you know, what fixes carbon dioxide, right? Like kind of what makes oxygen, the air that we all breathe, everybody thinks of trees and rainforests. That's kind of the number one. But especially here in St. Pete, being located so close to the ocean, we should be thinking about our oceans. And so algae, whether it's bacterial ones, cyanobacteria, or larger algae, are really what does all good proportion of the carbon fixation. And so especially in the offshore areas, like these big, vast portions of the open ocean, it's bacteria that are driving the carbon cycle. And then most of those viruses infect those bacteria because they're the most abundant hosts out there. So even your microbes have microbes.
And the interesting thing to me is when, if you think about it, having 10 billion in a liter of water, to me, that would be almost be like the whole liter of water.
Yeah.
But it's really not. And it's amazing that the research and the things that she's doing is so minute that it's oblivious to most people.
That's true. We don't even know it's there.
You know, if I held up a clear glass jar with this water in it, you would look at it and say, that looks like the most pristine water I've ever seen, right? Because everything in there is microscopic. You know, you just can't see it with your naked eye.
That's fascinating. So what are you working on now?
We have actually a lot of projects. So going to see what you guys are most interested in or what I can reel tea in on, I guess, with the fish jokes. So when I started, I really started down the microbial route, bacteria and viruses. And when we do that, we need to develop a lot of DNA-based methods, right? So we can't see them. In this clear jar of water, you look, there's nothing there. So we could put it under a high-powered microscope. And basically what we see are little tiny cells in the case of the bacteria or the viruses we can't even see with a light microscope. We have to go to things like electron microscopes.
So hang on a second. So in that liter of water that seems completely pristine, how do you extract something so minute? I mean, it's microscopic that you have a hard time seeing with a microscope. How do you get that?
Filters. We filter a lot of water. So I think, you know, while you go out on your boat and you cast your rod over and you wait until you get a bite, I just fill up giant, giant buckets of water and then I watch it drip through a filter. And our way of doing that is to catch those bacteria. And so our filters that we use are 200 nanometers. They're extremely small, but that lets us catch bacteria, and the viruses go through that. So we use even smaller filters for them. And so using that, we can kind of concentrate them out of the seawater. But then when we want to study them, like, what do? If you can't look at them, right? So you could describe you can see a bug in your backyard and say, this is an insect I've never seen before. How many legs does it have? You know, what color is it? What is its behavior? Since we can't do any of that visually, we really rely on their DNA. And so every organism has DNA. We have DNA. Our plants have DNA. Our pets have DNA. You know, your strawberry that you eat. We use strawberries all the time for education activities because if you extract their DNA, there's enough DNA there that you can see it with your naked eye. So we do this at Science Festival all the time.
I would never have thought that a fruit or a vegetable would have a DNA pattern to it.
Absolutely. Everything alive has DNA and even viruses, which the, you know, consensus is out whether they're
that intrigues you.
whether they're alive or not. So yeah, we can use this DNA to kind of target them and see, you know, what they are. So by sequencing their DNA in the same way that, you know, we could distinguish the different people. If we sequenced all three of us, I could tell you, A, that we're all human. That's good, just in case anybody was worried.
We wonder someday.
For that, we use kind of conserved genes, right, that can tell us, like, okay, this fish is a fish. And then we can go a level deeper and say, what species of fish is this? And then we can go even deeper into that and sequence full genomes and look at, like, what, you know, who was that fish's mother? Or in our case, we do this a lot for things like fish eggs. A fish egg is a tiny little circle. Think of caviar, right? Mm-hmm. You've eaten caviar. Mm-hmm. You can't really tell in this tiny little round ball what species it belongs to. And so while you might not need DNA barcoding to know that you've pulled up, what's your favorite fish to go
tarpon
after?
Fish.
Tarpon. So, you know, you pull up a tarpon, you know it's a tarpon. You don't need me to tell you that. But if you go out there and you pull a net and you get all these tiny little eggs, how do you know if any of them are tarpon eggs?
I have no idea.
I think the only way we could do it before the DNA methods came along would be to, you know, incubate those eggs in your bathtub for a really long time, which your family might not like, and wait until they start to grow up and see if there's a tarpon in your bathtub, right?
It's actually kind of funny because, as Allison alluded to, I do Gyotaku fish art, and I did convince my wife and let me store a tarpon in the bathtub for a couple of days.
All right, but you'll love this story.
Oh my gosh.
True story.
So if you don't want to be incubating all these fish and waiting for them to grow up, and maybe you want to be processing, you know, hundreds or thousands of these eggs, what we can actually do is take each individual egg, we put each one in its own tube, we add a little buffer to it, we literally squash it up with a toothpick. If you thought your job was boring, try being the person who has to squash 1,000 fish eggs a day into a tube. We extract their DNA, and then we go after it with one of these gene markers. And by sequencing that and then comparing it to big databases, we can tell you, this is a red snapper egg, this is a flounder egg, this is a tarpon egg. So you're probably thinking, why? Like, what do we care? But if you care about fish, which I know T-shirt certainly does, and you're trying to design strategies to figure out, you know, how many fish can we take? Where can we take them? What areas do we need to make sure are safe and preserved? You've got to think about all those life stages, not just where the adults are, right? Or where juveniles are, but also where are the areas that they're spawning their eggs? Because if you can't protect those eggs, and then where are those eggs going? If you don't know what they are, you know, you could be cutting out this whole stage of the life cycle.
So curious question is cutting out a stage of a life cycle and understanding what you do from bacteria and viruses. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had any correlation between some of the viruses that you study versus their attack on embryonic eggs?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So a lot of what we do tends to be like specific to a certain taxa. And that's the way when people go out, you know, and do a survey, you might be surveying the corals, right? And so you go out and you lay your transects and you dive them and you look
at all the corals.
Just a line, basically. So if you're going to do a dive, you might like lay a straight line and say, we're going to swim across this line for 10 minutes and count all the corals we see or count all the fish we see.
So for layman's terms, it's a grid pattern that so they know that I picked this up in this amount of time
right.
over this space.
So it's an imaginary line, or is it actually a physical line?
Usually it's a physical line.
It's a physical line.
Okay.
And if you want to survey what's on the bottom, it's often like a square, right? And so you drop the square and then you count all
What's the square made out of? I'm just curious.
PVC generally tends to be.
Okay.
If you've ever looked at a wreck dive, somebody doing wreck dives, they'll actually plot it. And in marine archaeology, we'll use similar type.
Okay.
And so I think even in the best studies that are trying to look at the whole ecosystem, it's really tricky to look at multiple things, right? Because most fish experts are not also coral experts, are not also invertebrate experts, and, you know, can tell different shrimp species apart just by eye. And so you try to look at all those things together. Then you add in the bacteria and viruses, which kind of no one can look at unless
except you have Maya
superpowers, like my microscopic, my super microscopic eyes. But yeah, so in that case, we use kind of different DNA methods, and this is a cool one too. So we use the word environmental DNA. And so if you think about like your CSI forensics, right, which I think a lot of people can relate to, after we left this room, someone could come in here with swabs and they could identify that all three of us were here, right? As well as everybody who used this room probably, you know, for quite a while in the past. And so just in the same way that we leave DNA behind everywhere we go, so do all the marine animals. And so the idea is that if you go out and you just collect your jar of seawater, it contains DNA of like all of the things that have been swimming through that area. So the fish kind of drop scales and they shed mucus and you have everything. You have bacteria and viruses obviously in that water physically.
Biological waste and all of
Yeah. So things like fecal samples, right? From various things that swum in there. And we're going to come back to feces later for those of you guys who are holding out for that moment. But we basically get traces of everything that was there. And so, you know, in your jar, we do this a lot right now in the Florida Keys and trying to understand what the diversity is at all these different levels and how it plays together. And so, no, I've never caught a sea turtle in my jar, thank goodness, because I don't know what I would do if that happened. But I have found sea turtle DNA in my jar, right? And so this lets us start to establish connections between like which types of animals are there at the same time, along with plants, and then even now linking that to the bacteria and the viruses.
So quick question for that. I mean, do you see seasonal changes between lunar cycles and temperature have variations on what you're seeing?
Yes, we're definitely seeing like temperature cycles, seasonal cycles, spatial cycles. We're not at the point yet where I can tell you what is driving those differences. So part of what we've been doing in the Florida Keys is a long-term monitoring project. And so, you know, if you go out and you sample one time, I always hear people say the analogy of a forest. Yeah, if you go to a forest in the winter, you might think trees don't have leaves. This is what they look like, right? You go back in the spring, summer, fall, very different scenarios. And so initially, we do see lots of differences in our different samples. But now the question is, you know, what is driving these patterns? We're doing monthly sampling to be able to track the DNA of all these organisms across all these levels. And then the thing is, patterns you see in one year, do they repeat in different years?
Right.
What's the impact of something like a hurricane going through the area or an oil spill or a red tide? Any of these things?
Yeah.
Sewage releases.
Sewage releases. I knew he couldn't wait to get to sewage. Allison, can you handle it?
Yeah, go for it.
All right.
Situation.
Why not?
So I think one of the coolest things about DNA sequencing is that you find whatever's there, not just what you're looking for. And so I was telling T this story earlier, but I got totally bamboozled by my PhD advisor when I was in grad school. I got brought in to work on this cool marine virus project. And then all of a sudden, he had me sampling sewage. Sewage is not seawater. Like, one day I'm on the California beaches, you know, of San Diego with my buckets, and the next day I'm at the wastewater treatment plant. And then, you know, within a week after that, I'm collecting fecal samples from my friends and family. Just not a progression anybody wants, right?
Did you question your choice at that moment?
Many, many times.
What am I doing here?
Exactly. And I promise, since I see you both getting squirrely, I did not bring any sampling containers today.
Thank you.
I'm not going to be reaching out to listeners of the podcast to contribute to our study.
I'm good.
Thank you. But when we started doing this, our goal was to look for human viruses, right? So we're sampling human feces. We want to find viruses that are important for human health. And I think, like many studies in science, you don't always get the goal that you're hoping to get, right? And so we were using a method called metagenomics. So where genomics is sequencing the genome of a single organism, metagenomics is doing that for a whole community. So in our case, we took our fecal sample, we added a bunch of buffer to it to kind of liquefy it. We shook the crap out of it.
Pun intended.
We did our filtration. You know, we purified the viruses really well. We extracted all of their DNA and RNA, and we sequenced them. And we just said, what types of viruses are here? And we did not find a lot of human viruses. The most abundant things we find are viruses that infect the bacteria in our gut, which are called phage. So there's lots of bacteria. They're going to be kind of the most abundant hosts, more than humans. And the other strange and super fun, this is my favorite thing that we work on, I think, was that we found lots of plant viruses. And so, yeah, I'm getting strange looks all around the studio here. But we eat a lot of plants in our diet, and some plant viruses are extremely stable. In fact, evolutionarily, they've used this as a strategy to spread themselves, right? So if something like a bird eats like a seed of a plant, right? And then it goes through the bird's system, bird's poop as well, right? And that could be
carried to— I read a book one time that says everybody poops.
Everybody poops. As scientists, I can back this up for you. It's absolutely true. Now, if you want a good one, there's a new book that just came out by a bunch of scientists that met together on Twitter called Does It Fart? That will answer that question, because not everybody farts. So you might check that one out. I have no stake in this business. If you want to enjoy
everybody poops.
Your kids will. But I know everybody poops. Right. So then when that bird poops, it's in a different location generally than it ate, right? And so that's a way that a virus can get from one place to another. And so we started finding all these plant viruses in human poop. And the coolest thing was that we could take those viruses and put them back on a plant, and that plant would get infected. So this means this virus survived all of, you know, living in the digestion system, low pH, stomach acids, all of that, and was still infectious afterwards.
That's fascinating.
But when you say infectious, it's not necessarily a bad infectious, just an infectious.
Correct. We have no indication that this is bad for humans. We're just kind of a vector in this case. But this virus in particular, that was really like the dominant virus. So like between a million and a billion copies of a gram of human feces. So not very much. I mean, just there's a ton of these viruses. The most abundant one is called pepper mild model virus. So it's a pepper virus. And it's super widespread in almost all processed food that involves peppers. So if you like salsa, you like hot sauce. It also infects bell peppers. So it's not just hot sauce. One of my favorite moments of this project was that I was in Singapore working with a genomics group, and we went around their food court at their genomics center, and we got one dish from each of the vendors there, and we tested them all.
And this was in China?
Singapore.
Wow.
So it's pretty widespread, and we've now done studies, you know, kind of throughout the US, and we find this a lot in sewage. And sewage is kind of this great integrator, right? Because lots of people's poop goes into sewage systems. And so it's a good place to like monitor for viruses of interest. But it's also, of course, can be a problem because there are sewage discharges, right? Intentional or unintentional. And treatment wasn't always designed to remove viruses. And so now, if you think we have this plant virus, and this plant virus is really abundant in humans, but so far we haven't found it in things like pigs and horses and cows. And so this makes it a really useful tool, because if you have to shut your beach down due to fecal contamination, right, that's bad. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for the people who live there. Like, it ruins everybody's Saturday, right?
So these viruses are good indicators, or a primary indicator, I would guess. But when you hear about a beach being closed, it's from E. coli and other types of bacteria. That's different from these viruses. But these viruses, what I'm understanding, is more of an indication of...
like a human-specific release. So you're exactly right. When beaches are closed, like what kind of happens as part of routine monitoring is groups go out, they collect the water, they culture it to see if they can grow E. coli from it, or they call them fecal coliforms, right? And so if they can grow these kind of indicator bacteria. And there's a couple problems with this approach. So it's a great approach, right? And it's cheap and it's easy to do and it's standardized and regulated. So these are all good reasons that we still do this. But there are a couple big problems. So the first is, if I go out and collect a water sample right now, I'm not going to know until tomorrow morning whether that should be closed.
Right.
So that means everybody swam all day today, that I'm going to close the beach tomorrow, and then I'm going to check tomorrow afternoon sample. And if that's clean, open it the third day, right?
There's a delay in the reporting.
Yeah, a big time lag. And then the other problem is that E. coli is kind of found in a lot of places. And so just finding it doesn't mean that there's necessarily a risk to human health, including it can have like reservoirs in the sediment, so it can kind of hang out in the sediment. And then maybe you just got a wind event that stirred some of that up. Yeah. Whereas this pepper virus, you don't find it out normally in the environment. And we've done some tests. It only hangs around in terms of being able to detect it for about a week. And so if we go out there and we can detect the pepper virus, we can say there is a fecal contamination event. It's likely human in origin. And, you know, you should close the beach. Those tests are much more expensive to run and you need specialized like labs and people with expertise and equipment. But those tests can be done much more quickly, like within hours. And then I think in a perfect world, you would then combine that. You would say, okay, we detect human-specific fecal pollution here. You would then combine that with all of this knowledge that exists in our community about the circulation of the water. So where does water come from? Where does it go to?
So I got to stop you there. So from what I'm hearing is this pepper virus is present in all fecal matter or human fecal matter.
Yep.
So when our sewage system goes through the tertiary process and it becomes reclaimed water and people are watering their lawns with reclaimed water, that's come from raw sewage. Is that pepper virus present in reclaimed water?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is. We can definitely detect it in the reclaimed water. None of our attempts to actually grow the virus out of reclaimed water have ever succeeded. And so it seems that it's inactivated. So you asked before about it being infectious. There's a big difference between it being present, like we can detect its RNA in this sample, versus it's actually capable of infecting something.
So a few weeks ago, there was a sewage release in Venetian Isles area, and it closed that portion of Riviera Bay. My question would then become, you know, people using reclaimed water and that runoff getting into Riviera Bay, can you detect differences between those pepper viruses that are contained in the reclaimed water versus a release?
No, we can't. And so what you would need to do is kind of know what your baseline values are for a given area and then see if you see a big increase on top of that.
Okay. Because, I mean, that's one of the big things here in St. Petersburg is reclaimed water and, you know, what we're doing with it and how much we're paying for it. And it's interesting to me that, you know, it's there, but it's fascinating for me from what I'm hearing.
And it's a really interesting issue for me when I moved here. So I moved here 13 years ago from San Diego, and I was just blown away by how well St. Pete has done with water recycling, right? And reclaimed water. And I went and toured the reclaimed water facilities. And, you know, I mean, fresh water is a big concern in having enough fresh water, right? And so if we can use reclaimed water for irrigation and things like that, it solves a couple problems because it solves how do we get rid of all of this waste? And it also solves how do we get enough water to be able to have our nice green lawns? But one of our concerns was like, could this transmit plant viruses to crops? Could this be a problem for agriculture? I think no is the answer, or at least not so far. So there have been reported problems in terms of like salts in the water and some sensitive plants, but it doesn't seem like the viruses are infectious. So that shouldn't be kind of a concern. From our standpoint, I think we talk about it as an ultra conservative indicator. And so it's one of the harder things to remove. And because it's really abundant, even if it gets diluted out, like, you know, you always hear dilution is the solution to pollution. Don't quote me at saying that. Yeah. Just kind of deferring a problem, right? And so there are a lot of things that our wastewater treatment isn't designed to take out of water. For example, chemicals such as like hormones, birth control, aspirin, like all these drugs that modern populations take. And so there's nothing in our designs to remove that. That wasn't what these things were designed for. And so I think it's a safe bet that anywhere we're detecting this pepper virus, like if we go out and we find it on a coral reef, that means that wastewater has reached that coral reef. Now, it doesn't distinguish between raw wastewater and tertiary treated wastewater. We always talk about building a toolbox to differentiate these different things. And so you'd want to use different tools in different scenarios. So this is just one piece of the toolbox, but it might be nice to know, you know, was there an intentional or unintentional wastewater discharge from a treatment facility, or was it just the horse farm up the road, right? Or, you know, I know there's always kind of discussions about, can we do horseback riding on the beaches and how's that going to affect the water quality, right? And so it's really nice to have tools that can distinguish between these different sources.
Well, if you think about it, on a Memorial Day or Labor Day weekend, you got, you know, 1,000 people on the beach too. And I'm not worried about the horses as much as I'm worried about little Johnny next door to me.
Absolutely. And don't forget all these things that we started the conversation with, from the fish to birds to alligators, they all poop too, right? And so there are going to be, for example, like high concentrations of E. coli in areas where there's a lot of waterfowl. And that doesn't necessarily mean that there's a problem, right? That
she said waterfowl.
Part of the system.
Yes, she did.
I promised I'd keep you guys amused this morning.
The wordplay is amazing. Yeah. So let me switch gears for just a second and ask you a little bit more about, what does an average day look like for you?
It's not nearly as fun as I think I've made it sound in the beginning of this podcast. And so I spend a lot of time looking at my computer, sadly, in an office, but thankfully my office has a really nice view, and that's one of the great perks of being here. So I'm a professor, so my kind of main responsibilities are teaching, and a big part of that teaching is mentoring graduate students, and I hope to be able to come back to that a little bit more, because all this incredible research that I've been telling you about, I don't do it. I'm sorry if I'm just ruining this. I wish that I did that all day. I wish that I was, you know, out on the boats and filtering the water and extracting DNA. But that is really my students that do that. And so the students are really at the front edge of the science. And people like me boss people around, hopefully nicely, beg people to give us funding.
Encourage them to do their best.
We train them, which is, you know, clearly important because these are the future scientists.
So interestingly enough, so I have somewhat of a science background as well, but so the initial collection and the quality of that data translates into the end result. So even though they may be on the grunt side of the work, it's very important for the way they're collecting the data.
Yeah. And they take it all the way through. So it's not that they do the grunt side and then I do the high level thinking. I mean, I like to think of myself as a high level thinker, but they're all the high level thinkers too. Our whole job is to train them to be us, basically, right? And so they collect the data, they generate the data, they analyze the data, they interpret the data and figure out what the next steps are. And so it's not saying, okay, you got that result, now you're going to do this. That's a very different thing than what we're doing, where we're saying, what are your results? Okay, what do you think you should do next?
Right. So it's critical thinking skills.
Absolutely.
Really trying to train them to be able to do this.
So interestingly enough, I used to work on boats, and one of the captains I worked with would never tell me how to do something. He would say, okay, it's gotten to this point. It's not happening from that point. Why did it go wrong? I'll help you. But it seems like that's what you're doing with your students as well, is letting them learn forward.
Absolutely. And we learn a ton from them too, right? I mean, I have people in my lab who have come from a huge variety of backgrounds. So we were recently doing a seagrass project, and I had a postdoc, so who's someone who's already earned their PhD, got a grant to come from Belgium. And so she came to my lab with a plant virology and a marine biology background, and we wanted to work on seagrass. So I connected her with some folks at Fish and Wildlife, and they were super awesome about getting us out there on the water and teaching us everything we needed to know. I think my favorite part of what I do as a scientist is being able to apply these methods across a ton of different fields. And so you have to be a little fearless in going into a new project, right? So did it concern me that I wouldn't be able to like identify a species of seagrass, or, you know, like that I didn't know much about their ecology? Sure. But I worked with experts who did know how to do that. And through that, we've done a lot of things. So I have a project right now collecting spiders, primarily in my backyard, and looking at their viruses. We've done mosquito viruses. We've done whitefly viruses that move a lot of plant viruses. And so it's kind of these same methods across a whole variety of problems. So I love problems.
Can I throw a project that you may be familiar with or not? In seagrass regeneration and prop scarring, it's a problem down the Florida Keys, and it's a problem pretty much anywhere where you have, you know, shallow grass beds. I have seen in the past, let's call it aqua, I don't know exactly the right term for it is, but you'll see short stands just above the water surface for birds to land on to fertilize those flats with their fecal matter. I'm assuming that you've heard of it, or because I know I've seen it in the Florida Keys. They'll do an acre or so of heavily prop scarred bottom that they'll do researches. Are those birds contributing to, you know, regeneration of those grass beds?
I have no idea.
Sweet. I gotcha.
So I'm also very unafraid. You'll learn to hear. So I have no idea.
I went fecal matter and I went waterfowl.
You did. Well, and one thing you've mentioned, Maya, that is something that a lot of people may not know is how much collaboration happens, in particular here in St. Pete, because you mentioned Florida Fish and Wildlife, which is literally next door to the College of Marine Science. And so you guys share resources, you're collaborating a lot, you're going out on vessels together and things like that.
This is a really collaborative time in science. So obviously I wasn't doing this, you know, 100 years ago, but, you know, if you look at like older science papers, there are a lot less authors. And if you look at current papers, there are these really long author lists. And I think what that reflects is we do a lot more collaborative science now. And so, you know, for example, with this fish egg project, we've already established T knows way more about fish than I do. And I have zero shame in admitting that. So I'm working with fish biologists who know when to go out there and collect these eggs. They know what it means that we found, you know, spotted sea trout here versus somewhere else.
You know, one of the interesting, Maya and I had the opportunity to briefly meet before this started. And one of the things that intrigued me was that they were finding fish eggs of species that you wouldn't normally associate with backwater grass flats and mangrove tidal estuaries.
So weird placement where they would end up.
So I promised you I would bring this list. So I guess we're going to do this live. So we did a small study when we started doing the fish egg work. We've now expanded it to the entire Gulf of Mexico. But when we just started really locally in Terracea Bay, and which is an area he's really familiar with. And our initial study was to ask the questions, A, could we do this? Could we get DNA out of individual fish eggs and identify them to species? B, did the fish eggs that we saw reflect the larvae or the adults that we saw?
In the local populations.
In the local populations. Because a lot of times people use the larvae that are present as kind of a proxy, a way of guessing who's spawning there, right? But larvae can swim and they're out there for a lot longer. And so the eggs, when they're released in the water, they just kind of passively float, right? And so we can work with physical oceanographers to say, okay, we think these have been in the water for about 12 hours. So if they're at point X now, where were they released to get to point X in 12 hours?
So looking at currents and flows and okay.
Absolutely. And so in Terracea Bay, our top five species of fish eggs that we found were common snook, striped mojarra, spotted sea trout, sea robin, and southern kingfish.
Interesting.
What surprises you, T?
So the mojarra is a forage fish for the snook, but the southern kingfish is, that's not like the king mackerel that you're thinking of. It's a different species. It's a smaller species.
Hmm. And we did a bunch of modeling to make sure that, you know, was it that these eggs could have been sort of laid outside of Terracea Bay and then pushed in by the currents? But actually the way we designed the sampling, these were really originated from Terracea Bay. And if anything else would be pushed out. So we think that, you know, them being spawned inside actually helps them get to their nursery grounds. But in contrast, those were our most abundant eggs. Now, our most abundant larvae were not those same species. There was very little overlap. And the larvae, we saw a ton of line sole and drum.
So let me ask a question. Black drum, red drum, croakers. So they're all in the drum family. Sea trout are also in the drum family.
I gotcha. You got me.
No, but it's interesting to me because, I mean, a lot of what she's doing on a molecular level has transcends to what I do on a recreational level.
Right.
Because everything builds off of those bacteria and the viruses are present. And that's the basis of what I'm trying to catch. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I can give you scientific names, but I'll butcher them. And that would probably answer your question.
And more interestingly enough, so some of the work that Moat Marine's doing as well with redfish releases and snook hatcheries and some of those things. Are you able to tell, and I may be way off base here with this, but are you able to tell how those populations, I would assume that they have a baseline DNA bubble of what they're reproducing and releasing into the environment. So do those releases have biological indicators that, yes, they are hatchery-based fish or native wild fish?
It can be done, not with the methods that we've been using. So the methods that we're using are going after a gene that really just lets us tell what species it is.
Okay.
There are more variable regions of DNA. You might have heard of microsatellites or single nucleotide polymorphisms where you're looking for like...
No, I haven't.
word of the day.
What is SNPs?
So SNPs are single nucleotide polymorphisms, and they're literally looking at in the four bases of the DNA, like, do you have an A at this position or do you have a T at this position?
What does that tell you then?
So that is where we can get at these really fine level population details. People use DNA a lot to determine, like, are these two populations connected or not? So we were involved in a study recently with deep sea squid. And the question was, in the areas of the Gulf of Mexico that were affected by the oil spill, right? Do those populations get, like, do they spread to other areas? Do they get replenished? So if there's a local impact, how much of an impact is it going to have on a larger scale or long term? And so you can use these other regions of the DNA that are going to be very specific to each species that you're studying to tell you, like, are these two populations breeding with each other, right?
Interestingly enough, and it's a huge economic deal from the red snapper populations. And the red snapper populations, it's been thought of as being a local population. But in what I've understood over through NOAA and some of the National Marine Fisheries is that it is a species that'll transect over large areas. So it's not a local population. And that has huge economic impact because of the economic driver of what the red snapper fishery is and how the government actually regulates that and the economic impact, not only for commercially, but recreationally as well.
And the currents are a really important part of all this, right? So if you want a fish population in a certain area, but if you protect that area, but all the eggs that are spawned in that area are just being, like, pushed into another area, you haven't actually helped feed adults in that area, right? And so you kind of have to think about how all these life stages fit together. If you're missing, like, a nursery ground, you can't protect a species, right? And so there's a lot of interplay. And if we can understand, like, here are the important reasons to protect because they're contributing to the next generation, whereas you could fish all you want over here because
it's not going to hurt anything.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, there's kind of, at least certainly can be a perceived, like, opposite interests here, right? Between the fishermen and the stock assessment scientists, right? But if everybody kind of works together, we can make smart choices about what to protect. And in some cases, the studies even show that by protecting a smaller area, you can have, like, more fish overall.
And that's a big challenge as well, to say that, you know, are we doing the right management practices to affect the overall populations? Because I know the West Florida Guides Association is having, they're going up to the FWC and actually recommending to them, even though all the red tide effects have been mainly south of Tampa Bay, but as a moratorium for redfish and snook harvest on a voluntary basis to help recover the stocks and the overfishing, because a lot of the commercial pressure from guides, they're coming up into Tampa Bay and it's putting more pressure on the Tampa Bay estuary from, you know, the sport fish, the snook, redfish, and those. So they're actually petitioning the FWC to put a moratorium on harvest of redfish and snook in Tampa Bay.
So we're running out of time. I feel like we could talk for hours on this. And I know we didn't even cover all the topics that we thought we might. Is there anything, Maya, that you want to add that we didn't mention? Anything that we should bring up?
Just something for anybody local who might be listening. You had originally asked me maybe to think about where people could get more information if they're interested in this or in any other topics. And a great event that we have coming up in October, on October 20th, which is Saturday, is the St. Petersburg Science Festival. And this is on the beautiful USF St. Petersburg campus. It's right downtown and everybody is there. So
if you haven't been, it is a phenomenal event.
Fantastic.
And if anybody locally has children that have, my kids actually love it. I'm kind of water passionate, so it's easy for me to get my kids engaged with it. But I see kids that have no experience with the water whatsoever really light up and their eyes go, wow. Yeah.
And it's the water. It's also robotics, drones. It's a little bit of everything. We're going to do an innovation district 10th this year.
Oh, fantastic.
And so we're actually going to highlight the interconnectivity. So taking art, marine science, and life science, and how do they play off each other?
I paint fish.
There you go. We'll get you in there, T, painting fish.
When I'm not running the activities, I'm checking out all the other booths. Like, right. Last time we were next to NASA, and, you know, I was kind of like looking over there, like, what are those guys doing?
That's Did you say cool. far out?
Nicely done. And it's on Saturday, October 20th from 10 to 4, free event. As Maya said, it's USF St. Pete campus. And it's also, we have to mention, there's actually 2-for-1 kind of festival going on.
Marine Quest.
Tell them about that.
Yeah, so Marine Quest, I started way before the St. Pete Science Festival and is in the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission building. And so it's literally right there. You can just walk from one event to the other. And there, you know, you can basically get a behind the scenes into all of fish and wildlife. And so there's actually way more to do there than you could possibly cover in the time of the science festival.
You can't get to it all in a day.
and things are different every year. So if you've come out before, hopefully you've been watching it and want to come out again. And if you've never been, it's just an absolutely great time and great opportunity to help make connections.
And it's not just walking by a table to pick up some information. It's actually a hands-on interactive day that truly gets you engaged with what's going on in those areas.
And I also have to mention that Maya is going to be one of our speakers at an event that we have October 10th, which is State of the Science. And it's modeled after the city's State of the City and State of the Economy. This will be the first year we're doing it. As you can tell from the conversation with Maya, but also all the other scientists and researchers in our community, we have a lot going on. And a lot of times we don't even know about it, but they're known outside our community for their papers, for their speaking engagements, for their research and collaborations. So on October 10th in the evening from 5:30 to 8, we will have 8 speakers, all TED Talk style. So very fast and short, 6 minutes each. I don't know how they're going to do it.
We don't either.
I know. And we're going to hear a cross-section of what's going on in St. Pete. So check out the St. Pete Innovation District website, which is stpeteinnovationdistrict.com, and anything else that I've left out today.
If you're interested, reach out. I mean, I don't want to get inundated with 800 emails this afternoon, but I think, you know, people have a misconception that scientists are just focused on their research and don't care about the implications, don't care what the public thinks. Like, couldn't be further from the truth. We spend a lot of time, a lot of energy trying to communicate, to reach the public through Pint of Science events, you know, through science festivals, through public lectures. We want to hear from you. We want to tell you about what we're doing. That's, I think, the most exciting part of the job. We want to inspire your kids to become future scientists, or maybe you to go back to school and be a scientist. So yeah, be in touch. Bother us, please.
That's awesome. Well, thank you, Maya. Thank you, T.
Thank you for having me.
This was our inaugural podcast. It was a chance for us to test this methodology and have a great conversation. I will tease a little that our next
podcast... She said tease.
I did. Tease. The next podcast is going to be with Chad Marin from St. Petersburg College Innovation Lab and Dr. Allison Watson from the USF St. Petersburg. They're going to be talking about STEM and education. And in particular, and I'll ask you two this question, which it was something I never thought of. How does a student who has low sight or is blind learn about cells? They can't see a microscope. Chad's figured out a way to help train them and help
them. Can I guess?
Yeah, go.
Do they 3D print them so they can feel them? Very cool.
Very good job, Maya.
That is cool.
Yeah, so that's the next conversation. So thank you all for joining us. This has been Innovation in the Burg. Have a great day.